Let's have the discussion. You're listening to Canter with Scott and Adam.
Welcome to Canter. I'm Scott Hillier and I've got Darren Hickman, CEO of Afri Helios Global, joining me. Thanks for coming on the show, Darren, and welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on board. I'm really glad to participate.
It's a fascinating one. Diana approached me about having a chat with you. A few things really stood out, and I guess the African nature of what you're doing. It seems like a relatively young, new market. So can we just maybe start off with a little bit of your background? I know you grew up in the States, is that correct?
That's right. I'm a New York City boy, born and raised in Queens, New York.
Very interesting. And now you've ended up in Africa, and you're trying to do a bit of a pan-Pacific or pan-global approach here between Africa and the US. Is that correct?
Well, you know, what we're doing is we're a pan-African cannabis company, meaning that we're not specifically focusing on like Lesotho, where our first license is. We really are looking to leverage the advantages of the continent in general, particularly Southern Africa from a climate perspective, but Africa in general, with the intent of exporting to the global market. And then as the market within Africa develops itself in terms of legalization around commercialization or the ability to sell within the countries, we're also going to focus on Africa. In the short run, what you're finding with a lot of the African countries that are legalizing it, they're only legalizing it for export. You're still not able to sell or use legally within the countries, but we're looking, you know, to change that and open up that market also.
Okay, so you've got a bit of advocacy ahead of you by the sounds of it. And you seem like the perfect man to take up the mantle of that, because you are quite active in advocacy in a range of issues. So I want to get down to what sort of drives you to become the man you are today. And what I'd like to start with is how did you start? You know, you grew up in New York. What was life like for you? You've got quite a business background. So if you're able tell me how you went through from childhood into the business world and how you've found yourself in this new market.
Sure. I'd love to. I'll try to keep it short because, you know, I could go on and on for days. But I grew up in New York City, grew up in a single parent household where my mother was just amazing and smart. Is I think she recognized that, you know, with a single parent, often, particularly with boys, when you're working all day, in many ways, the community helps develop or raise your kids. And so she made the effort to make sure that she could put us in the best neighborhoods that we could afford, you know, just to improve our chances, you know, our life chances. Because often communities, you know, you have young, motivated kids, but if they're in the wrong community, the wrong environment, that can have a significant negative impact on them. So I think she recognized that quite early. And so, you know, I was lucky to grow up in Southeast Queens, you know, fairly middle-class African-American neighborhood. You know, we were still, although it was a middle-class neighborhood, you know, we were the poor kids in the neighborhood because we were a single mom, you know, just struggling. But I think when I look back on those years, I think some of the learnings that I took from those days is, recognizing that, you know, you can go through adversity, you can go through challenges and, you know, keep pushing forward and get somewhere. And so, you know, I was lucky in the sense that when I decided to focus on something, I could do well. So in terms of my grades, I was lucky enough to, you know, do well in high school and on my SATs and get into a great college, which opened up some doors for me. And that's actually where my first interest in Africa, particularly Southern Africa, started. Now, I went to Hamilton College, a small school in upstate New York. And this was during the late 80s. And this was at the height of what's called the divestment movement that was happening in the United States. This was when there was still a lot of protest around trying to end apartheid. And we were trying to get our college or university to disinvest from American companies that were still active or invested in the apartheid era South Africa.
Sure.
And I met a couple of, you know, South African students who went to Hamilton with me. And, you know, I distinctly remember, you know, one morning waking up, I lived in what was called the, you know, African Latin Cultural Center. And I could hear this stomping downstairs in the house, like, well, you know, what the heck is that? And, you know, there's this sound that, you know, African women, and I find Middle Eastern women also able to do it. I'm not even going to attempt it, but it's like this high pitch, like, la, 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 la. But it woke me up, and it was the South African students celebrating that Mandela had just been released from prison. Very cool. You know, it was just, I get goosebumps even now talking about it. It was such a pivotal moment, an influential moment for me. And, you know, it piqued my interest in Africa. But, you know, I have gone on with life. You know, I joined after college. I was a paralegal, corporate paralegal at a major law firm in New York City, Paul Weiss Rifkin. And this is right after apartheid had ended. And they had an exchange program where they sent some of our corporate lawyers to South Africa, and some of the South African attorneys came to Paul Weiss. And, you know, I made friends with a South African law lawyer, Marco Masati, who went on to be this major private equity lawyer. But again, he kept my interest, you know, in Southern Africa. I started exploring it more. And I also decided, instead of going to law school, because I hated being a lawyer, I found it to be particularly corporate law, I found it to be just dreadfully boring. And always wanted to be the guy sitting on the other side of the table, you know, the guys, you know, at the investment banks. And so I decided I was going to go get my MBA. And the school that I picked, University of Michigan, at that time was the only like top five business school in the United States that put students on the ground for internships in Africa. Mm-hmm. And so I chose to, you know, go to University of Michigan, and I had an internship in Windhoek, Namibia for about 4 months working for an American company that was operating there. But what was great is, I got on the ground, I got a chance to experience the opportunities here, build a network, developing network on the ground, and, you know, went back to finish up my second year of business school, decided, you know, at some point I'm going to make the move back here. But first, you know, I need to go build my skill set. So after getting my finishing up at University of Michigan, I went to Wall Street, joined J.P. Morgan, which was an amazing experience in one sense. One of my areas of focus was working with professional athletes and entertainers and helping them manage and build their wealth. A lot of people don't recognize how much money these guys make. I had one client who was 18 years old, just out of high school, and he had signed a $100 million contract with the Detroit Pistons back then. Wow. But the surprising thing is, as much as these guys make so much income, 70% of professional athletes within 5 years after retiring are in serious financial trouble. So I saw a huge gap there to really kind of help these guys while they're playing, earning this, you know, high salary, to really build wealth so that when their careers are over, which is short, you know, the average professional career, depending on whether or not it's American football or basketball, can be anywhere from American football short, about 3 to 4 years, and basketball can be 5 to 6 years, average career. So short, you know, high income earning years. But we work with these guys to help them build, you know, leverage their brand while they're playing, while they're popular, to, you know, acquire not just, you know, liquid assets like stocks and bonds, but, you know, income generating assets, you know, acquiring businesses and building businesses such that when their careers are over, they have this asset that can continue to generate income for them and help them maintain their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So that was, I co-founded that group at JP Morgan. But as much as I enjoyed it, you know, I still felt the pull of, you know, Africa. It was something that was always in the back of my mind that I wanted to do. And I think also, to be quite honest, I think I was somewhat disillusioned, you know, you know, on the outside, looking in, Wall Street and even professional sports entertainment, it just seems like this glitzy and glamorous world. But once you get in it, you know, it, you know, it's not always what it seems. And I think I was quite disillusioned and, you know, looking for change. And you know, it's funny how, you know, life, you know, has these sudden turns. I have a cousin who lives in Johannesburg, and this is back in, this is around 2000. Mm-hmm. And he was getting married, and he said, "Hey man, won't you fly over for our wedding?" So, you know, a last minute decision. I said, "All right, fine. I'll come over for the wedding." And it's amazing how when you get away from your day-to-day life, the clarity that you can sometimes, that you get around your choices and where you're going. And I just remember being on a bus, you know, family took this, you know, family outing since so many of us were in country. And I literally one day just said, "That's it. I'm done. You know, I'm leaving Wall Street. I'm leaving JP Morgan. I'm quitting and I'm making the move. You know, to South Africa, because the longer I stay in New York, the more difficult it'll become for me to make that move."
Yeah.
But I might as well do it now when I don't have any obligations, you know, other like family. I'm not married. I have no kids. I'm just going to do it now. And so I literally, after that trip, I got off the plane. When I went into the office, I gave my resignation, tendered my resignation immediately. Didn't really have a plan, flying by the seat of my pants, but because I had developed somewhat of a network in the region, I knew I could, you know, create a soft landing for myself, which is what I was able to do. So for a couple of years, just to make the transition, I worked for Investec, which is another well-known bank in South Africa, Cape Town. But then moved on to, you know, building businesses. I led a startup for a major company here in South Africa, built a couple of other businesses. Even for about, you know, 4 years, went back to the U.S. to help a former J.P. Morgan colleague build a wealth management firm back in the U.S., focus on, again, professional athletes and entertainers, and then came back. You know, the markets in 2008 kind of hit a wall. And so I was like, let me take my butt on back to South Africa. And so, you know, I came back and continued to do that. You know, coming to, you know, the whole cannabis thing, you know, my experience with cannabis, you know, prior to joining Afro Helios is, you know, I was much like a lot of people, you know, occasional recreational user on the weekends. You know, I didn't have any real, I didn't use it for any therapeutic value outside of just kind of relaxation, you know, Friday or Saturday night. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to, you know, wind down from a tough week at work. And I just come home and I'd take a puff or two and relax. And so to a large degree, that was my experience of it until a few years ago. A very good friend and former colleague, his son is severely autistic and violently so, both violent with himself and with the people around him. So much so that he had to go to the hospital often and he had to wear a helmet at home because he would hurt himself. He would throw himself off second floor. Second story balconies. He would hurt his father, broke his arm. And so they were struggling to figure out, you know, how do we resolve this? And after some, you know, trying a number of different things, they discovered that a combination of CBD and THC nearly overnight got rid of all of those symptoms. You know, prior to that, you know, the boy was not communicative. He didn't speak at all. After, you know, putting him on this routine of this combination of CBD and THC, he was communicating, he was loving, he stopped, you know, being violent. And, you know, so right then and there, you know, as much as I kind of had heard and understood that there was therapeutic value to it, it really made it much more immediate and tangible for me to see the impact of it. So I started seeing it then. Then a few years ago, back at the end of 2019, another American that's here in Southern Africa, Forest Branch, reached out to me and said, "Hey, Darren, we've got a license in Lesotho. We are excited about, you know, taking this company to the next level. Would love to have you come on board. You've got, you know, great startup experience background. You've been working on the continent for quite a while. So you understand the space. We'd love to have you join us." And yeah, I honestly didn't immediately say yes, because I had to take a step back, because I had to, you know, it's as much as it's a growing industry and it's being legalized. I had to kind of do a bit of soul searching. Mm-hmm. I had to challenge some of my own assumptions and thinking that I didn't even realize I had about cannabis. And, you know, are people going to judge me? Yeah. Are they going to tease me? Hey, you're just another drug dealer. But, you know, after thinking about it, you know, over the weekend, I was like, this is something that I have to do. The value from a therapeutic perspective is major. The value on the African continent, I think, is so great. It has the power to be transformational in many different ways. And I just want to be a part of this wave that's happening. And so I, you know, joined Afro Helios, you know, back then, and, you know, have not looked back since. You know, it's been one of the most challenging and exciting journeys. And we're still literally just getting off the ground. You know, COVID kind of set us back a bit last year because we weren't able to travel. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of our road shows and raising capital, you know, we lost quite a bit of time, but you know, we're building that momentum again. But it's been challenging, but it has been such a satisfying journey. And I'm just excited about what the future holds for Afro Helios and just the cannabis industry in Africa in general. So there it is.
Congratulations.
Not as short as I would have hoped.
That's awesome. That was really cool. Congratulations on taking that role and taking that leap. And I think it's great that you challenged yourself and looked into it a bit deeper. I'm sure most people, before they put themselves out into this industry, have to do a little bit of that soul searching and really just ascertain if it's exactly what they want to put themselves out there as. So well done. And I think it's amazing that there's people such as yourself really driving things in Africa at the moment, trying to get things up and running and trying to get progress. So yeah, well done for that as well. I really, really respect what you're doing. And that was a great story as well with your background, man. You're very articulate. You're clearly a very intelligent man. So that's just another weapon for Afro Helios, isn't it?
You're going to get us where we need to go. So.
Yeah.
That's along really with cool. Along with a great team that I have and team of advisors, or, you know, board of advisors, and then business partners that we're bringing on board. In fact, one of our key business partners is out of Australia, too, believe it or not.
Okay. Who's that?
A group called Farm Out.
Farm Out. Okay. I'm not familiar with them, but that's really cool.
They're headquartered in Australia, and they also have been active in Lesotho in Southern Africa. So they've got deep experience in the region.
That's really cool. Lesotho, it's a place I'm sure a lot of people don't know a lot about. It looks like a fascinating country. And I guess when I look at some of the details about Lesotho, it seems like a relatively challenging landscape, but also a rich landscape. And I find it a little bit contradictory because you got this really high altitude out there, don't you? It's one of the highest altitude countries on the planet in terms of if you take the lowest point in the country, the lowest point in Lesotho being 1,400 meters. So the altitude, I think, obviously, is that going to bring some low temperatures?
One of the challenges with the altitude is, you know, the low temperatures that they can experience sometimes. It's a good thing and it's a bad thing. In one sense, because of the altitude, you know, we get the low temperatures sometimes, certain times of the year. Mm-hmm. But we also get 300 days of sun on average in a year, which is amazing. And then, you know, the climate, the area, the air, it's just amazing. It's ideal for cultivation of cannabis. And so what's great about it, we're going to be doing greenhouse grows, but because of the amount of sun that we get, it allows us to do 3 to 4, you know, harvests per year, you know, depending. And so that for us is a great advantage and at a much lower cost than, you know, what you'd find, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere.
That's really cool.
We're convinced that, you know, Africa in general, but particularly Southern Africa, is going to become kind of the low production cost jurisdiction of the world because of this amount of arable land, the climate, the skills that, you know, are here. People don't realize that, you know, Africa is the largest, both producer and consumer of cannabis in the world.
Wow.
And so there's generations of, you know, deep kind of cannabis cultivation skills that exist here that we want to leverage in order to, you know, take this up to the next level.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that prior to today, actually, that Africa was the leading consumer and producer of cannabis on the planet. I guess when you think about maybe Morocco and I guess Malawi and places like that, South Africa, of course, yeah, it sort of adds up, doesn't it? Make sense.
It does. And obviously it's all illegal, you know, it's all been, you know, illegal, you know, over that time.
Yep.
But it's such a part of, you know, the tradition and culture. It's been used therapeutically, recreationally, industrially, you know, over the centuries.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you mentioned the amount of arable land. And I think Lesotho itself has nearly three quarters or 75% arable land. You look at images of Lesotho, and it's green. Every image is really green, isn't it? So it's clearly good earth that you'd be growing in. You'll be in greenhouses, so you're going to be growing like hydroponically, or
no? We won't be growing hydroponically. You know, we're deciding right now on what exactly how we're going to do it, but it's not going to be hydroponic. We are in the process right now of bedding down who our head grower is going to be, mm-hmm. farm out. And we're right now building out our concept and design. So we're going to, over the next 2 months, 2 to 3 months, kind of settle on exactly how, you know, we're going to be growing, but definitely greenhouse grow. We're also looking at, believe it or not, we're in conversations with a couple of other countries in the Southern Africa region. Can't mention them just yet because it's too early stage, but
sure.
Similar greenhouse grows in some other, countries in the region.
Yeah, that's awesome. What sort of challenges do you forecast? I guess you're in the middle of a seed raise right now. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
okay. So once you've got your startup capital and you start putting your facilities in place, what do you forecast to be some of the hurdles that you'll confront?
You know, we suspect that there's going to be a fair number, particularly such a, you know, a regulation heavy industry and regulations that are evolving. So that's one of the first areas we anticipate just a lot of challenges, is just navigating this complex network of regulations, particularly when you're exporting. This complex web of regulations in, you know, Lesotho and South Africa, where we're going to be exporting, those kinds of things we anticipate being more challenging and complex than the rest. Now, a lot of the other issues, you know, growing is not necessarily easy, but it's straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to, you know, once you've got, you know, you understand what you're doing and how you're doing it, it's fairly straightforward. You're in control of that process to a large degree. You know, it's when you start, where I anticipate a lot of challenges is in those areas outside of our control. So, for example, you know, we're looking down the line to enter the U.S. market. Because of our connection there, we see that as a logical place market for us to be looking.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge we're facing, obviously, with the U.S. market is that at the federal level, cannabis is still illegal.
Yeah, so
and so as much as it may be legal in a bunch of different states in the U.S., because you've got to go through a federal curtain, if you will, you know, in terms of the import process, mm-hmm. to get into the states, we can't do that until it's legalized at the federal level. So we expect that that's going to be challenging, although it's encouraging. The news has been encouraging as of late.
Absolutely.
When we first started, you know, got this thing off the ground or started with this prior to the elections, you know, we were estimating about 36 months before we could enter the U.S. market.
Mm-hmm.
Before the regulations would change, based on what the new administration appears to be saying, you know, sometimes there's some conflicting messages that come out of it, but to a large degree, there seems to be the impetus
mm-hmm.
to, you know, legalize at the federal level we've ratcheted down that time frame to about 18 months that we're hoping that this can be legalized. If that does, that removes a big hurdle for us, because that, you know, is the largest market right now in terms of, you know, countries. It will be the largest market. And given our relationships, our networks on the ground there, we can make, you know, we can have great traction in the U.S. So I think we see that as a potential challenge. And then just, you know, the usual challenges that you have, you know, with startup and scale, because we're looking to be, you know, vertically integrated. That's another important thing. Looking to be vertically integrated, you know, as you progress, you know, through that value chain, and, you know, we anticipate having to pivot quite a bit to adjust as we evolve to each stage of that value chain.
Yeah, very interesting. And it's interesting that you're looking to operate in a number of different countries and jurisdictions. Can you tell me, enlighten me a little bit about the African landscape, particularly the Southern African region? Because I'm, I guess, a bit undereducated on legal status amongst the countries. I'm sure South Africa's just had a couple of positive movements. But, are you able to tell me about the legal status of in Lesotho, then South Africa, that which surrounds Lesotho, and then maybe some other neighbouring countries, and perhaps what you forecast for those countries in the coming years?
Right. So it's beginning to evolve in Southern Africa particularly. So South Africa, cannabis has been decriminalized. Mm-hmm. It is legal medicinally. You know, medicinal medical cannabis is legal. However, as much as it's been decriminalized, you still cannot buy or sell cannabis. And so they're still in the process right now where they are trying to put together that legal framework that legalizes that process. It was supposed to have been completed by now, but they're behind. I anticipate it might be another, you know, year, mm-hmm. 12 to 18 months before they finally put that to bed.
Sure.
So right now you're finding the bulk of the cannabis-related activity in South Africa is focused on export to the international market.
Sure.
They've legalized it from that perspective. So you can cultivate, manufacture, process, and export. One of the other advantages with South Africa is it's part of what's called the PIC, the Pharmaceutical Inspection Convention.
Okay.
Why that matters is for those who are, particularly those who are looking to enter kind of GMP, produce GMP quality output, mm-hmm. they need to be able to review your operations in order for you to be accredited,
sure.
as a GMP operator. And if you're not, you know, if the country is not part of that PIC, it makes it extremely challenging, nearly impossible, but challenging to get that, you know, that EU GMP certification.
Yeah.
South Africa is part of the PIC. And so what that's done, there are some processors and manufacturers who are EU GMP certified on the ground. So what that allows us to do, for example, is, you know, we can cultivate in Lesotho, which is not yet part of the PIC.
Mm-hmm.
However, one company has been able to get EU GMP certification after, I think, 3 or 4 years going at it.
Sure.
But what it allows us to do is to export our, you know, our output from Lesotho, have it processed in South Africa at a GMP certified operator, and then allows us to access the GMP, you know, those EU, all those GMP markets until we build up our own process, our operating, our manufacturing and processing.
Mm-hmm.
We don't plan to out the gate as part of our phase one to build our own internal processing. We just don't want to overcapitalize, you know, the business too soon. It puts you under pressure. So initially, we're just going to focus on getting our cultivation operations up and running. We're going to be launching our brand platform. We're also going to be getting that up and running to take advantage of some short-term opportunities. And then possibly about 24 months down the line, begin looking at building out our own processing operation.
Yeah, it's a nice way to scale it and generate some cash flow. On the on the path to developing that processing plant. You talk about.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I apologize. I mean to cut you off. I realize I digressed. You asked me about Southern Africa and the legal landscape, but I digress. Just quickly, the other countries, Zimbabwe has legalized for export. Uganda, Malawi has just recently issued licenses.
Cool.
Ghana is looking at it at the moment. So there are a number of countries that are in various stages of legalizing it in some capacity in Africa, but very few, in fact, none have legalized it for internal buying and selling. You know, Africa, really? You can use and grow your own, but you can't buy and sell it.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting. You talk about the way you're going to scale your business. I guess one thing that intrigues me is what sort of capital are you're hoping to raise to get that phase one sort of part of the project up and running and building a cultivation facility. What sort of numbers are you shooting for that?
Sure. So our seed capital raise right now is $450,000 dollars. That's going to fund our cultivation concept and design. It's going to get our initial team on board, and it's also going to jumpstart our brand platform. So we're already developing a couple of products and brands that we're over the next 12 months we're looking to get into the market.
Yep.
So it's going to fund that. Then with respect to the actual cultivation and getting seeds in the ground for our Series A, we're estimating that's going to run us between $6 to $8 million US dollars to get that up and running.
Sure. So
yeah.
So yeah, it's still a relatively high cost facility to get up and running. So are the savings going to come purely on based off that labor aspect of it, the cheaper labor?
Well, yeah, I think in terms of those two things, in terms of that upfront cost, for a greenhouse operation, that's kind of in the range. That's not particularly expensive, nor
exactly,
on the cheap either. That's fairly standard for what we're looking to do. Now, in terms of cost benefit, cost savings operationally, I think one, it's yes, labor is one of those. Things like electricity and water are cheaper. And then also because of our ability to, get 3 to 4 harvests per year, our productivity per square meter, if you will, becomes even better. And so those are the areas where we really feel like we're going to be able to save from a production, cultivation cost perspective. And, leverage that to, move into other segments of the value chain.
What sort of photo periods do you get out there in Lesotho in terms of what sort of fluctuation do you get between winter and summer in your daylight hours?
So what kind of what period do we get?
What sort of fluctuation do you get in your daylight hours, the period of daylight that you get between winter and summer in Lesotho?
That's a good question in terms of the fluctuation. I would need to kind of go... I need to find that out in terms of, what that is. I don't know that off the top of my head, to be quite honest, between summer to winter daylight hours.
Would you be planning on supplementing light for these greenhouses? Will that be required?
Yes, we'd be looking to supplement light for the greenhouses. But, particularly out the gate, as I said, that's why we're bringing on some key advisors and key partners that are going to really help. We start delving into the much, much more technical aspects
because
I don't come out of the commercial cannabis industry.
Yep. You're a,
we're going to be bringing those skills on board,
that's cool.
World-class in order to make sure that, we are operating at a world-class level. That's extremely important for us that we are seen as operating at that level because sometimes perceptions in Africa, people often have this tendency to kind of underplay, how businesses operate and how things are done on the continent.
Yeah, okay.
And we want to be sure, one, it's a perception and it's not always, doesn't always match reality.
Mm-hmm.
But it is important for us that in terms of what we put out into the market, that it's seen as, you know, a consistently high quality in order to really, you know, change that perception.
That's really cool. How do you find the people in the industry, the culture, with your interactions so far?
You know, that's actually a great question. You know, I'm seeing this almost like this dichotomy happening. Okay. You know, I'm seeing people like me, for example, you know, people like me who don't have like deep, deep, you know, cannabis experience, mm-hmm. whether it be, you know, pre-legalization or subsequent.
Yep.
So you've got these kind of old school kind of entrepreneurial or corporate guys,
sure.
you know, coming into the industry, bringing that background. Then you also have the guys that have been around for decades playing in that space and the unique culture that's, you know, emerge from an industry that's like that, that lived often in that gray space.
Sure.
And, you know, those two kind of cultures coming together and, you know, trying to find a new way of kind of working together. And so it's been interesting just to, you know, to see the differences, you know, some of the old school guys and how they operate and then some of the newer guys and how, you know, they want to operate, yep. you know, in this industry. And so it has been quite an experience with that. And I've also, honestly, I've had to also, you've had to learn how to navigate, mm-hmm. Particularly in any emerging, you know, industry like this, where the regulations are not always as clear and there's lots of gaps. It can sometimes also attract some unsavory characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Into the industry. And so you really have to learn how to do your due diligence, you know, before you step forward with anybody. Mm-hmm. That's been very important. And number two, you know, don't judge, you know, a book by its cover. You know, you really, particularly I find in the cannabis industry, and that's one of the things I do love about it, is in many ways it's peeling off the old kind of, you know, dry kind of corporate look and feel, and guys are much, much more casual, much more relaxed in how they look, feel, and operate.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that. I mean, even though I come out of, you know, the Wall Street, you know, pinstripe suit, you know, environment, I'm enjoying just being able to throw on my jeans and a t-shirt and still not stand out.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I like the way you answered that question too. It's really cool. Now, you're a little bit vocal and you're proactive in trying to promote, I guess, equality on a number of fronts. And I admire that about you. So can you tell me a little bit about how you hope to use your profile and your developing sort of input into this space, how you plan to use that to promote equality? And I guess I've always seen this new industry as a chance to start a lot of things again and I guess realign perceptions and values. So can you tell me how you hope to use your position to I guess put a bit of yourself into the community and really promote equality?
No, the last thing you said, you know, with this new being a new or renew, old new industry, because it's been around for, you know, ever.
Yeah, that's true.
But the new iteration of this industry, I agree. I do believe that there is an opportunity to kind of set things straight, if you will, or embark on a new path around how things get done. Mm-hmm. And so I see that, you know, on two levels, looking at it, you know, starting with Africa, for example, and often how these kinds of industries operate, these extractive industries. Mm-hmm. You often find that, you know, international companies come in, they extract, you know, low value raw materials, they export it, you know, with minimal value. The value gets added outside of the country, mm-hmm. Exported to, you know, to the Northern Hemisphere. And so many of these, you know, African countries lose out on a couple of things. One, just their tax base, because it's leaving at such low value, the taxes, you know, they collect less taxes on it, sure. which, you know, doesn't help them as much. And then also in terms of the skill set and the training that, you know, the local population would get in terms of being able to add value, you know, before it leaves, you know, the country or the continent. Mm-hmm. So So for us, it's important to kind of change that way of doing business as much as possible. You know, we want to add value before it leaves the country to make sure that that local tax base is getting the benefit of that value add. It gives us an opportunity to really focus on skills transference, bringing skills to the local population. It gives us a chance to, even in terms of just the cultivation piece, and in addition to our own cultivation, working with small scale farmers, you know, to help them grow and evolve. And so that's something that's important to me. And, you know, for example, using the U.S. Market as an example, you know, particularly, you know, given America's unique history, well, actually, it's not unique. It's this kind of thing happens all over the world. But America's history, you know, with the criminalization of cannabis, to a large degree, the African-American community and the, you know, community of color really were the focal point of that criminalization of cannabis.
Yeah.
You know, I could go on in terms of how it fit into, you know, the privatization of prisons and, you know, by criminalizing it, it increased the number of people going to prisons, you know, making it much more profitable, you know, growing the, you know, police presence. But the point being is that, you know, the African-American community was by and large the target and the focus of that criminalization of cannabis. And now as legalization is occurring, to a large degree, we have been left out of it for varying reasons. Some as simple as, you know, if there's systemic racism in a general, you know, system, just because cannabis is now legal doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be any different.
Yeah.
So you've got some of those legacy issues. Some of it is, you know, just lack of access to capital in order to help, you know, to get some of these, you know, cannabis businesses off the ground. Some of it is just not always having the relationships, because like any industry and in many countries, those who get access of first dibs are the ones who are often most connected. And so they benefit from it the most. And so as a result of that, to a large degree, you know, communities of color have still been left out of that. And, you know, for me, given my background, you know, as I mentioned, I was an activist back, you know, going back to university days. It's always been something that is important to me, and particularly in this area of wealth building. You know, African Americans are so far behind in comparison to the rest of the country in terms of, you know, average wealth, as a result of, you know, literally centuries of systemic racism and the impact that it's had. We're trailing. And so I see industries like the cannabis industry as an opportunity to give people a chance to build wealth, to start businesses, you know, grow the businesses and create wealth and create opportunities for others. So that's an important part of, you know, who we are and what we're doing. Now, it's an important caveat. You know, at the end of the day, Afro-Helios is it's a business, it's a cannabis business, and we're out there to be profitable. Mm-hmm. We're out there to grow as much as we can. And so that's our focus. And so we have, it's not like, all right, we only do business with these people or those people, or it's not that at all. Now, for us, we feel like it's possible to add social equity, bring that value, you know, to the party and not have to, you know, say, all right, we're only hiring Black people. We're going to hire the best people for the positions and the jobs in our company. But one of the things we're going to do is also make sure that, you know, we reach out to those communities because there are, you know, qualified, some of those best candidates are in those communities. And so it's important for us to make sure that we make that effort, reach out to those communities to connect, and, you know, help those guys as we're trying to help ourselves grow. Even, you know, the capital raising, you know, we're running right now two campaigns. We're running what's called a Regulation CF crowdfunding campaign, and we're running a Regulation D private placement, which is your more traditional kind of capital raising focused on accredited investors and institutions. But on that Regulation CF crowdfunding, one of the reasons we really wanted to do this is we felt like these kinds of investment opportunities often are not available to many communities of color in the United States. They're not aware of them, or they just can't access them because it's usually only available to accredited investors. And with the crowdfunding campaign, you can you know, you can invest, you can get involved for as little as $250 to participate. And so in some ways, we feel like this is a bit of a democratization of access to, you know, investment in these kinds of opportunities. So that was important for us to really, you know, focus on, you know, getting that crowdfunding campaign off the ground to open up this investment opportunity to people that traditionally wouldn't have access.
Yeah, I love it. That's really cool. Are you able to tell some listeners that, you know, if they are keen to jump onto that investment, how they should approach it, what channels they should go through?
Sure. The quickest and the easiest way is to go to our website, you know, afrahelios.com. From afrahelios.com, there, depending on whether or not you're an accredited investor, an international investor, or a crowdfunding investor, our website will direct you to the right platform. So if you want to do the crowdfunding, there's a link there that will take you to our crowdfunding platform. You know, if you're an accredited investor or institution, it takes you to that particular page for that, you know, for those investors, and similar for international investors. So just, you know, Afrahelios, that's Aphrihelios, Afrahelios.com. And just as a quick side note, Afrahelios, you know, what that means. But Afri, the A-P-H-R-I is just a play on, you know, Afri, A-F-R-I for Africa. And Helios is the Greek word for sun. And, you know, we came to that. You know, Lesotho has 300 days of sun on average per year, as I mentioned earlier. And so we felt like that was a great kind of, you know, play on that competitive advantage in Afri. So that's how we came up with Afrahelios.
That's really cool. Darren, I've got to say, I've had many, many approaches from startup companies in their seed raise, you know, hoping to chat on the show. And I guess one reason I've not gone down that path to date is I don't really want to become an infomercial podcast. So I would normally say no, but there was something that attracted me to you and your company and what you're doing. And I'm really happy that I took this opportunity to reach out. And I really thank you for taking the time out to chat with me, because it's been really great to meet you. And I really think you're going to achieve some pretty great things. So thank you very much for coming on the show. And I really look forward to checking in with you a little bit down the track and seeing where you're at once you've got something on the ground, because I'll be following you quite closely, Darren.
Please do. And thank you very much for, as I said earlier, thank you very much for having us on. Because I do recognize that often, guys, you know, particularly for people like us in the startup phase, because we're so, you know, focused on selling to get people to invest, I get why some podcasts don't want to do that, because they don't want to be an infomercial. So I appreciate and respect that you had us on, because I think we're bringing more to it than that.
Yeah, there's a bit more to the story, and it's really cool. It is. You're bringing a really good energy, and just a lot of things about you are really interesting, and I'm sure you're going to be an absolute asset to the cannabis industry.
I hope so, man. I'm excited about what this industry can do, and you know, really, just I've. Is what do they say? I burn the ships, as they say. I'm focused on this industry. I'm here now. And so I'm going to be 150% behind getting both Afrahelios off the ground, but just, you know, the cannabis industry in general, helping to drive it forward so that it can be what I believe the transformational industry that it can be. And I'd love to kind of stay in touch as we evolve, you know, as we grow and evolve. Come back on and tell you more about what we're up to.
Yeah, that's brilliant, man. Yeah, on that note, thank you very much for your time. And like you say, it's going to be exciting chatting in the future, man. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I'll talk to you again very soon, hopefully.
Take care, man.
Take care. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Cantar. Any guest views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and not necessarily those of the hosts. Cantar strongly suggests listeners research local, state, and federal laws and regulations before conducting any cannabis-related activity.